Welcome to this week's podcast of Breakthrough Church from Bayswater in Melbourne, Australia. For more details and further resources, visit breakthrough.org.au. We hope you enjoy today's message.
Now, friends, we're going to learn about Turkey in transition. Will the Ottoman Empire return? If you had asked me 2 years ago about the coming again of the Ottoman Empire, I would have laughed and said that is the most ludicrous thing I've ever heard. Remember, our Anzacs attacked the Ottoman Empire in Gallipoli. And frankly, they did a really good job. They didn't technically win the battle, but they weakened the Turks so much that we won the war. And yet, there is a new wind blowing. The Ottoman Empire, my grandparents, all four of them were born in the Middle East in the waning days of the Ottomans. The footprints of this empire are still all over Israel and the Middle East till now. And of course, they're etched in the Australian psyche because of Gallipoli and the Great War and the fact that in the year 2017, we have so many centenaries like the capture of Beersheba, like the capture of Jerusalem, and the Balfour Declaration on the 2nd of November. That's a big deal. And expect jubilation in the Jewish camp, expect trepidation from the Arab camp. It all goes with the territory. But welcome to our topic here. And remember, we are Teach All Nations, and you're most welcome to contact us through our website. And please, no private recordings of this message. I want to read to you from Ezekiel. I'm going to read to you from Shakespeare as well, but before I do, from Ezekiel 38, verses 3 to 6. Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and I will turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth and all thy army, Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya, Gomer, and the house of Togarma. This is an amazingly important prophecy. What I want to help to show you is as Turkey goes in transition, we are possibly seeing things come into place for the last day's events, bringing and ushering the coming of Jesus. So the topic is called Turkey in Transition. Will the Ottoman Empire return? And I think on this note, I'm going to open up in prayer. Father, we thank you in Jesus' name for our meeting tonight, your early warning service, part of the Understanding the Times tour. And I pray for open hearts tonight, hungry hearts, thirsty for the Holy Spirit as they take deep bites out of thy word. I pray that we will have our curiosity aroused and that we will see marvelous things in the days ahead. And that, Lord, let us remember, we're not to fear what lies ahead. We're to look up and lift up our heads because our redemption draws nigh. For this we thank you in Christ's name. And the people of faith said, amen. Amen. Okay, well, let's meet William Shakespeare. William Shakespeare made this quote in Othello, his great play. Valiant Othello, we must straight employ you against the general enemy, Ottoman. And then we had, who's the next one? I think it's Martin Luther, the great reformer. Martin Luther had this to say, the Turks are the people of the wrath of God. All right, not a ringing endorsement, is it? And then James I, who gave us the King James Bible, said this, he said that there is a conflict between the baptized race and the circumcised turbaned Turk. And Christopher Marlowe, the English playwright, said, Turks and Tartars shake their sword at thee. What I'm trying to convey here is that Europe looked at Turkey as the neighbor from hell. Why was Turkey a bad neighbor? Why were the fences between Turkey and Europe not high enough? Well, in our time, they wish they were high enough with all the migrant flow coming out of Turkey and flooding into Europe, especially in the year 2015. But friends, we're going to learn that Turkey is one of the most important countries in the world. And you may get some insight why that is and why it's worth praying for the Turks. So who are these people that famous Europeans of yesteryear were complaining about? Well, first of all, they have a twin identity. The Turks don't actually come from Turkey. And Turkey, in the time of the New Testament, as far as we know, didn't have Turks. Where did they come from? We believe they came from Central Asia. And they came from the mythical Oguz Khan, and some say from Noah himself. Well, of course they came from Noah. There's Shem, Ham, and Japheth. They had to come from one of them. But anyway, they come from Central Asia, from the warrior class. Think of Mongols and Tartars and other Central Asians riding on their horses, conquering, occupying, wreaking havoc. That flows in the Turkish blood. Now, in addition to their ethnicity coming from Central Asia, they made their way westward about 1,000 years ago, westward to what we now call Turkey. As they're making their way westward, they managed to fit in, getting converted to Islam. Now, they were shamanist before, and now they've become Muslim. And they're going to park themselves in what we call the Anatolian Peninsula. We'll talk about that in a second. And as they park themselves there, they're going to a country, a land that already had empires, that already had other religions, not just Byzantine Orthodox Christianity, but it also had all kinds of heathen rites. They had the Hittite Empire even before the Byzantine. And so when the Turks come, they just add another layer of religion, namely Islam, to what has already existed. It's like sort of adding a few more levels to a house or a few more layers to a cake. And it's interesting because though the Turks are part of the 85% of the Muslim world that are Sunni, their version of Islam really is in a class of its own because they do have this, well, this combination of their own version of Islam plus a little bit of, shall we call it, souvenirs from the past. For example, you may have seen whirling dervishes, men wearing skirts and then twirling round and round. And how they don't get dizzy and fall down, I don't know. That is so much part of what they do there in Turkey, but it's nothing to do from what we know of classic Islam. That is what they picked up from a previous era. Not only were the Turks different to the Arabs, and please don't call Turks Arabs, they don't like it. They don't like Arabs, and I don't think Arabs like them either, even though they look so similar, right? But the Arabs got mentored by the Greeks because they are close to the Greek cultural zone, but the Turks more closer to the Chinese cultural zone. So they really are more Asian in that sense than the Arabs, although the Arabs, of course, are from Asia too. So let's take a look at the land. How many of you have been to Turkey already? A few. I think some of you have taken to Turkey. A few of you. Yes, we have a great time. Turkey, the land, not the people. It is known as Asia Minor, and it's known as the Anatolian Peninsula, because it is a peninsula. What is interesting is that it has, within its borders, what we call biblical regions. Students of the New Testament may recognize some of these names, like Pontus, Bithynia, Cappadocia, or they call it Cappadocia, Phrygia, province of Asia, where Ephesus is located, Galatia and Cilicia. Cilicia is where Paul comes from, Paul of Tarsus. Also, as I said, it was home to the Hittite Empire, the Byzantine Empire for over 1,100 years, and then the Seljuk Empire, and finally, the Ottoman Empire. We'll learn about the Ottomans in a moment. The location of Asia Minor is incredibly important. It is like the hub of a wheel between Europe to the northwest, Asia to the east, and the Middle East to the south, southeast, and even southwest. And so when you're ruling a country like that, you will have a lot of connections and influence. How does Asia Minor figure in the Old Testament? Well, possibly the Garden of Eden may have been there and may not. It's either in southern Turkey or in some part of Iraq. But for sure, Mount Ararat is in Turkey. Mount Ararat is famous for Noah's Ark, of course. And the Euphrates River and the Tigris River flow through Turkey. Remember, the patriarch Abram sojourned in a place called Haran. Haran is in southern Turkey. Jacob sojourned for 20 years with his uncle Laban in a place called Padan Aram. That too is in Turkey. And 5 out of the 8 place names found in Ezekiel 38 involving the Gog and Magog invasion are, guess where? In Turkey. How about the New Testament? The New Testament and Turkey, or Asia Minor, 3 missionary journeys of Paul are there. Paul, of course, was born there in Tarsus, and he is a favorite son of that city to this day. New Testament epistles were addressed to churches or people from Asia Minor, including Galatians, Ephesians, Colossians, Philemon, or Philemon, 1 and 2 Timothy. And then let us not forget the 7 churches of the book of Revelation found in chapters 2 and 3. Are you getting the message? Turkey is part of the land of the Bible. That's why it is an appropriate place to do part of your Holy Land study, Holy Land pilgrimage, and so on. Because of the rich Christian heritage, there was a large Greek and Armenian community in Turkey. You may hear the statistic thrown around that Turkey is 99% Muslim. Well, that is correct, but please understand, Turkey only became 99% Muslim in the 20th century. Prior to that, there were literally hundreds of thousands of Greek Christians, Armenian Christians, and so on, living in that land in the time of the Ottomans. That's a very important point. So here's a little map of the 7 churches of the book of Revelation. It's interesting, if you study chapters 2 and 3, the 7 churches, or it's really the 7 cities that hosted the 7 churches. It is said in a clockwise-like fashion, starting with Ephesus, and then Smyrna, Pergamum, you're going north, and then you go a little bit further north to Thyatira, and then you start going south on the clock to Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. Of these 7 cities, I have taken at least 3 or 4 groups. Of them, 4 of these sites are very impressive. Ephesus is like the top archaeological site for tourists in Asia, in Turkey. Cruise ships stop in Kushadasi just so the people on the cruise ship can have a day at Ephesus. It's that popular. And nearby is the traditional tomb of the Apostle John. Also, impressive ruins are in Pergamum with an Acropolis, with the seat of Satan, which you read about. You also find great remains in Sardis. And very impressive is Laodicea, only excavated in the last few years. If you had gone there in a decade ago or so, it would have been just a mound. They have excavated. It's amazing. All right, so that's a little bit more about Turkey. I'll show you a photo of Mount Ararat. Just, you know, something to see. Very impressive. It's on the border with Armenia. You can literally see Mount Ararat from the Armenian capital of Yerevan, but I think the border only opened recently between the two countries. Let me also take you now to Cappadocia, or Cappadocia, which is mentioned twice in the New Testament. Very interesting geological formation. They call it the fairy chimneys. Cappadocia has underground cities where people hid to flee from persecution. And they also have cave churches. The caves aren't very big, by the way, but they actually had church in a cave. And one of the names of the churches was the Snake Church. I don't like snakes, so needless to say, I didn't go to church there. But it's a fascinating place, one of the well-hidden secrets of global tourism. And when I take a group to Cappadocia, we always go on the hot air balloon, and they think they've literally gone to heaven for that hour that they're in the air. You don't even feel the balloon going up or down. It's like the magic carpet ride. All right, so let's now meet the Ottoman Empire. And will this empire come back on the world stage? Good question. Well, let's first of all see what it has to offer. This empire, first of all, had longevity, over 600 years, from 1300, only closing up shop in 1922. It took a world war to knock them out of business. And then it spanned three continents. It was very multi-ethnic, multicultural, somewhat tolerant in an oriental despotic way. In addition to that, they offered people like the Jewish people and the Arab people relative autonomy and relative religious freedom. Jews fled to the Ottoman Empire when they were expelled from Spain, Isabella and Ferdinand, in 1492. You may or may not be aware, but that Islam occupied parts of Spain and Portugal for seven centuries. Interesting, because jihadists like Al-Qaeda and Islamic State say, we want Spain back. That's why there has been some terrorist outrages in Spain. Not as many as you would think, because the Spaniards have learned some counter-terrorist technology. But they're called in Arabic Al-Andalus, and so the jihadists say, we want Al-Andalus back, because once it's under the realm of Islam, it should never leave. But in 1492, the Moors or the Muslims were expelled, and so were the Jews. I can't remember what the statistic was. Could have been 100,000, 150,000, and many of them went to the Ottoman Empire, to North Africa, to Turkey, and they were relatively well received. The thing about the empire, they were the first Muslim entity to not only fight by land, but they actually had a formidable navy. That's a first in the Islamic history. A formidable navy which caused them to conquer territory in North Africa, in the Middle East, and they even captured parts of Europe. Europe was under Turkish, Ottoman, Islamic rule. Because of their Central Asian background, that meant that the Ottomans were always fighting, either fighting to take territory or fighting to retain territory. I'm told that in 622 years of Ottoman history, there was only 24 consecutive years of not having any war. Only 24 out of 600. Does that tell you why Christopher Marlowe, James I, Martin Luther, and so on said what they said? In addition to that, let's see the map here of the Ottoman Empire. All right, now you can tell they had all of North Africa except for Morocco, amazingly. Morocco eluded their grasp. They had Arabia, including the holy cities of Arabia, as well as the Persian Gulf. They went up all the way to the Black Sea, and then look how much of Europe they had. Just go across, they had from Greece in the south, all the way up to Budapest, Bulgaria, Romania. I mean, they were spreading all over the place. They were parked outside the gates of Vienna, I say that figuratively, for nearly 200 years. They were like the python ready to devour the egg. Well, with that in mind, let's have a look at the python. No, not the python. Let's look at the egg. The egg is Vienna. 1683, the Siege of Vienna. This has got to be one of the most important military campaigns, certainly in European history, and possibly in all history. Because, let me tell you, this is a favorite story of mine. The Turks wanted to take Vienna. Why did they want Vienna? Okay, let's go to the next slide, because it's the capital of the Holy Roman Empire. In other words, it was the headquarters for all of Central Europe. Already, Southeastern Europe was under the crescent of the Turks. And now they were not trying to take Central Europe. They sent 130,000 soldiers to take Vienna and immediately took all the suburbs. All that was left was the walled old city with St. Stephen's Cathedral, which is very iconic. It's there right now. 20,000 Viennese defenders were trying to hold out behind the walls to 100,000 plus Ottoman troops. And the Turks were burrowing under the wall, ready to emerge inside and take Vienna. It was actually a very serious conflict. That's why the alarm bells were ringing in Germany, Scandinavia, England, and Scotland. The Pope of that day said, "Could somebody, anybody, please save Vienna?" Because Central Europe was at the mercy of the Turks. In fact, the Siege of Vienna has been rightly called the most blood-filled military campaign on European soil until Stalingrad in 1942 in the Second World War. The Turks were about to emerge inside the walls of the city and capture Vienna, and guess what? At the 11th hour, the Polish king, Jan Sobieski, came to the rescue with a coalition of troops, sent the Turks packing, and Vienna was saved. This siege of 1683 is still emblazoned on the European psyche until now, as we're about to see. It's even possibly part of the reason that the EU doesn't want Turkey to join them because of what happened in 1683. And you know what? What you're going to discover is it's grossly unfair. Because Turkey is no more today, or at least until recently, was no more like the Ottoman Empire than Angela Merkel is like the Nazis, or Shinto Abe is like the Tojo fascists of the Second World War. Just as Japan had been rehabilitated, just as Germany had been rehabilitated, so Turkey had been rehabilitated thanks to Ataturk. But for some reason, Turkey's not given credit for changing 180 degrees. But anyway, that is the siege of Vienna, and I'll tell you a quaint little story. The Turkish commander of that siege was called Kara Mustafa. He went to the playboy, laid back, half-drunk sultan in Constantinople and said, "Your Excellency, give me permission to take Vienna." Now, the sultan was, you know, womanizing, drunk, all this. Soon as he heard the word Vienna, he sobered up. Vienna? Vienna? You want to take Vienna? Yes, sir. I want to take it for your majesty's honor. And for once, the sultan was showing good sense. Didn't happen often, but this time it did. It says, if you go to Vienna, it'll be dangerous. The sultan was actually younger than Mustafa, the commander. So the commander said, look, please go back to your harem, have your alcohol, have your fun. Leave it to me. I will deliver to you Vienna. And so the sultan took a green cord. This is a legend. I can't verify it, but it's a good story. And he tied it like a necklace around Mustafa's neck. And he says, go take Vienna if you can. But if you fail, hang yourself with this cord. When Jan Sobieski won the siege of Vienna, Kara Mustafa withdrew. He still had the green cord around his neck, and within less than 4 months, he was hung, apparently on that green cord. So, welcome to the siege of Vienna. But lest we forget, we cannot mention Turkey without mentioning the Anzacs and the Gallipoli landing of the 25th of April, 1915. I can never forget the 25th of April because that's the day I got married. I got married on the 25th of April in the wonderful city of Jerusalem, and I get a telegram or a message from Australia that said, congratulations, you're getting married on Anzac Day. I didn't know anything about Anzac Day. I'm an Arab American living in Jerusalem at the time. So, of course, I've learned since. And Anzac Day is, of course, our very beloved holiday, what is so heartening is that younger people really feel so attached to Anzac Day. And it, I guess part of the reason is Australian identity came on the world stage because of the valor and the courage and the mateship that was shown in that campaign. But let us also remember that our troops were attacking the Ottoman Empire and that our troops were facing a formidable foe in the name of Mustafa Kemal, who became later known as Ataturk. So let's meet Mustafa Kemal. He doesn't even look all that Middle Eastern, does he? He's fair-skinned, blue-eyed, light hair. Born not even in Asia. He was born in Thessaloniki, which is Greece, in Europe. But he's a Turk, through and through. By the way, the Turks look like everybody because the Ottoman Empire had so many nationalities and they did so much interbreeding that some of the Turks look, well, they look like many of you here. All right, and they even had a female prime minister that resembled Hillary Clinton in those days. Tantu Çiller was her name. So the Ottoman Empire was going to come into a collision course with Mustafa Kemal. He was the hero for the Turks of the Gallipoli campaign. He gave Turkey the only military victory they received in the First World War on Turkish soil. The only victory. And then when Turkey lost the Great War, Greece attacked Turkey. And Greece maybe wanted to, you know, take land in Turkey, perhaps even take Constantinople back, which they had lost, you know, 450 plus years before. And they called on this man, the Turks, to rescue them. And he did. He sent the Greeks packing. And then because of that, he was able to establish the Turkish Republic. He abolished the Ottoman Empire. He called them usurpers, corrupt. We don't need them. We don't want them. Get out of here. We're going to be the Republic of Turkey, established on the 29th of October, 1923. He is indisputably one of the most successful modern revolutionaries in history. Modern history, I should say. And I'm going to tell you about his revolution in a moment, but he is like the George Washington of Turkey. Mr. Ataturk succeeded to negotiate with the Allies to give Turkey the borders you now see. Had nature taken its course, Turkey would have been a rump of what you see now. But he basically got all of the Anatolian Peninsula up to Mount Ararat, and 4% of Turkey is actually on the European continent in a place called Thrace. You can see the upper northwest corner. And as I said, Turkey is a bridge between Europe, Central Asia, Russia, and the Middle East. That's part of its importance. As well as the fact that Turks have been showing leadership in the Muslim world for nearly the last 1,000 years, not only in the Ottoman Empire, but even to this day. Now, Ataturk wanted to take this country and make it homogeneous ethnically. So what he did, and it's pretty sobering, he had a population transfer. That means that Greeks living in Turkey were now sent to Greece, even though their ancestors had been there for hundreds of years. And Turks that were living in Greece were sent to Turkey. Now, they weren't called Greeks. They were called Turkish citizens that speak Greek. Or they were called Turkish citizens that spoke Turkish living in Greece. All right? So they never called them Turks in Greek. I just learned that recently. I was amazed. But that's what he did. We are more familiar with population transfer like India and Pakistan in 1947, Israel and the Arabs in 1948. But this was a major one. And it's very unknown. And that's why Turkey today is 99% Muslim, because the Greeks and the Armenians have been either moved or killed or what have you. In addition, Ataturk had a vision. He says, if Turkey doesn't come to the 20th century, it has no future. It's backward, it's feudalistic, it's corrupt under the Ottomans. So I wanted to be secular, westernized and democratic. So he single-handedly abolished the empire. And remember, the empire was also known as the caliphate. Interesting, because we're hearing that word again. And that the Ottoman Sultan, the one that ruled the empire, doubled up as the Muslim caliph, or in Arabic, khalifa. So Ataturk gets rid of all of that at the stroke of a pen, and nobody could stop him. This guy is so audacious. He did all those years ago what probably no Muslim leader would do today. Absolutely revolutionary. He, not only that, he moves the capital from Constantinople and it goes to Ankara. He then bans the fez, the men wear, and the veil that the women wear. He replaced the Muslim calendar with the European one, the AD that we have. He then got rid of the Sharia, or Muslim law, and substituted Swiss civil law. He said that Muslims could intermarry and could change their religion without penalty in the new secular, Western-leading, democratic Turkish Republic. He also, this was a big one, he changed the Arabic script of the Turkish language to Latin script, the one that we use. Now, could you imagine if the Prime Minister of Australia said, we'll still be using English, but we'll use Arabic script from now on? I'm sure that idea wouldn't get much traction. But Ataturk changed the alphabet. Woo! Can you imagine what that would be like? But he did it, and he got away with it. He also was very progressive. He gave women the vote and said they got equal rights in a divorce because he wanted a prosperous, modern, secular Turkey. And with that, let's now meet the modern Ataturk, but of a very different sort. His name is Recep Tayyip Erdogan. A lot of us like to say Erdogan, but it's actually Erdogan. And he is the president of Turkey. He has been the leader of this nation since 2003. And he's in no hurry to leave office. Most of the time he was prime minister. Recently he became president. And president is like a figurehead thing, but Mr. Erdogan doesn't want to be a figurehead. So he had a referendum on Easter Sunday, 2017. And I guess he's on his way to being now an executive president, not a figurehead. He has been popular in some quarters because he has, well, under his watch, the Turkish economy was energized. Remember, from 2003 till now, wages went up 3 times. Now, some say it's because he handled the economy so well. Some say, no, it had nothing to do with him. What it had to do is with outside powers artificially propping up the Turkish economy to fatten them to the point of being the Trojan horse to make them attractive so they could get into the European Union and have this big Muslim country in the European Union. Only God knows for sure which is the correct version. But Mr. Erdogan is without question the most powerful Turkish leader since Ataturk, without question. And he's not going anywhere soon. But is he trying to mold himself like Ataturk? Is he committed to democracy and secularism as Ataturk? Remember, secularism has become almost like a religion to many modern Turks. If you ever meet some of the modern Turks, particularly the young ones, many of them are so secular, they would out-West the West. They party, they nightclub, they drink, they smoke, they eat pork, and they're living the full worldly life. Now, some of them are religious, but they are actually very, what's the term? They want to combine the progressive side of the West and mix it with their religion. So, you have that version too. Mr. Erdogan is not secular. He is an Islamist. His wife covers her head. This was unthinkable in times gone by, but it's becoming more and more the norm. In Istanbul, because of secularism, you would never hear the phrase Allahu Akbar as a a cry from a minaret. Well, now apparently you're starting to hear Allahu Akbar. Is Turkey in transition? For sure. The question is, where is she going? Is she going to jettison Ataturk's secularism and democracy and pro-European attitude and pro-Western attitude? And remember, Turkey is an ally of NATO. It's a NATO country. And it's a strong military. So we are just going to have to watch and see. But let's learn a little bit more. Turkey has connections. Because you see, that light green area on the map is what they call Turkestan. And Turkestan means land of the Turks. And Turkestan, as you can see, encompasses a lot of what we call Central Asia, because that's where the Turks came from. And of course, there are Central Asian countries, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, all former republics of the Soviet Union. And Turkestan, land of the Turks, includes Oghuz Turks, Uyghurs, Kyrgyz, Khazars, Kazakhs, Uzbeks. The western side of Turkestan includes Azerbaijan, Turkey, and Tatarstan and Crimea. The eastern side is a place called East Turkestan, but in Chinese, it's called Xinjiang. That's the far western province of China, called Xinjiang, but it's full of Muslims, the Uyghur people. They're all part of this thing we call Turkestan. Well, what do you think Mr. Erdogan wants to do with Turkestan? He wants to connect. Because after all, they have something in common. Technically, nothing wrong with that, per se. But remember, the Ottomans also go to the west side. They were in Europe, the Balkan Peninsula. And so they occupied southeastern Europe for centuries. That's why Kosovars, Bosnians, Albanians converted to Islam. Not all, but this is why we have white European Muslims. Now, it's interesting, the Albanians, who are white Europeans, 70% Muslim, 30% Christian, the Albanian Muslims are very relaxed and they coexist with Christians very well, and it would be hard to imagine them crying for jihad or condemning infidels. I personally know two Albanian men. They were Muslim. They came to Christ. They're now Pentecostal pastors in Queensland. They're doing a wonderful work. And they still have relatives that are observant Muslims. Every now and again, an imam will come from the Middle East to visit them and try to win them back to the fold. But these guys are, they're Albanian. And Bosnians and Kosovars also converted. So see, because of what has been happening in the last few years in Europe, especially since the end of the Cold War, we have now Albania is an Islamic Republic and Bosnia is an Islamic Republic. We actually have Islamic Republics in Europe, and Kosovo is an Islamic Republic, and Macedonia traditionally is Orthodox. But they've been having such an influx of Muslims, if they're not careful, they may have an Islamic Republic of Macedonia as well. It's something to watch. Now, if Turkey connects with Central Asia and with the Balkans, like one Turkic superhighway, sort of like a British Commonwealth for Turks, as long as Turkey is secular, I don't see any problem with that. But if Turkey goes eastward, jettisons secularism, jettisons democracy, takes autocracy, becomes fundamentalist, then we have perhaps a different story. Let's go back to Vienna. Okay, see, Turkey reaching out to the west, Turkey reaching out to the east. Let's go back to Vienna for a moment, but to the 21st century. Fritz Bolkestein, he's from Holland. A former EU commissioner made a most incredible statement in 2004. And he said, if Turkey enters the European Union, the liberation of Vienna in 1683 would have been in vain. That is a pretty weighty statement. apart from the fact that Europe hasn't forgiven Turkey for Vienna's siege, but it's also saying that you're letting Turkey in and that Turkey could be a bad influence in Europe. My response is Turkey might be an even worse influence outside of Europe, because if it's in Europe, there is some, how should we say it, mellowing that happens. If it's outside, that's another story. And another man said, the siege of Vienna, 1683, Islam seemed poised to overrun Christian Europe. We are now in a new phase of a very old war. Friends, is Turkey in transition? Let's learn a little bit about the general jihadist scene today. And does Turkey fit into this at all? You see, as the Jews are returning to their roots and returning in immigration to Israel and reviving a biblical culture, a biblical language, a biblical currency, and so on, Arabs are also returning to their fundamental roots, and for that matter, so are the Turks. So let's learn a little bit about the Salafists for a moment. Salafists is a group of Muslims. They want to return to an original, organic form of Islam. It's not unlike fundamentalist Christians who want to cut across lots of tradition, a century's worth of tradition, and go back to a biblical, spirit-filled, simple, organic form of Christian faith. Now, they want these Salafists, this branch of Islam, to have a caliphate. The caliphate is meant to be a cultural, political, and religious entity. It's an empire, basically. And they say you can bring the caliphate through education, through culture, through commerce, and so on and so forth. They don't even mention the word conflict and jihad. They want a caliphate, or a caliph, I should say, Khalifa, because he is replacing the messenger of God, which is their prophet Muhammad. And of course, in the Salafist creed, you must have Sharia law. That's the 7th century Muslim way of life. And Sharia law represents the moral and religious law of Allah. It is the only source of legislation. It's the only governing authority. All other realms are deemed illegitimate because they do not practice the way of Allah, the Sharia law. Interesting, because, many Muslim countries don't have Sharia law. Most of them don't have Sharia law, certainly not to the full extent. The Salafists would like to change that, but peacefully in some cases. All other realms and ideologies, they say, cannot last because they're in contradiction and they're in conflict with Allah's decree. Only the jihadists take this Salafist creed to a new level, a violent level, a warlike level, and that is why we have these terrorist groups that sincerely, if they could, would like to start a caliphate starting in Al-Andalus in Spain all the way to Indonesia. Just not long ago, there were some headlines in our local Australian papers talking about in neighboring Indonesia, a nation of over 200 million people, by the way, that they are dealing with a potential of at least 500,000 wild-eyed jihadists. Now, these are our neighbors, friends. Yes, we do have an ocean. Yes, we do have a lot of land, but still they're our neighbors. It is no coincidence that Australia is trying to support the Philippine government in an insurgency on the island of Mindanao. Why? Because the Islamic State, having lost territory in the Middle East, is now trying to take territory in the Philippines. Well, that's too close for comfort as well. So jihadism has this amazing ability to spread, and it's something to watch and pray about. Let's go to Turkey again. They had a referendum on Easter Sunday, 2017. At least they do vote in Turkey. This is more than I can say in some of the other countries of the region. Proper voting, I mean. And so they had a referendum because the president, Mr. Erdogan, wanted them to approve 18 amendments to the Turkish constitution. He wanted to take the presidency and turn it from a figurehead to an executive presidency. That the president becomes both the head of state and the head of government, which means, I guess, you don't have a prime minister anymore in Turkey. Major offices, ministers, everything appointed by the president. This referendum, even though the yes side had strong, heavy campaigning, not just in Turkey, but wherever there were large groups of Turks living outside the country, particularly in Europe, apparently diaspora Turks could vote in this referendum. So they were campaigning heavily in those places. Despite the heavy campaigning, they only managed to muster 51% of the vote. And 49% did not approve. Mr. Erdogan is taking that as a win and proceeding to become an executive president. Look, I can't say too much except he lives in a palace, $600 million palace in Ankara, fit for a sultan. If you've ever seen the palaces of the Ottomans, like Dolmabahçe on the Bosporus or Topkapi on the hill, you will get an idea how grand a life they lived, and it looks like those days may be back again, at least the regal lifestyle of the leader. Turkey's transition. Is she really going to turn back to her Ottoman roots? Well, first of all, she's been knocking on the door of the European Union for years. Years. She wants to be part of the European Union. She wants to be considered part of Europe. And Europe is making every excuse under the sun to keep the process dragging out forever. Even little puny Cyprus, right to the south of Turkey, the Greek section of Cyprus, applied and has been in the EU for years and years, and here's Turkey still left in the cold. Now, there are reasons for that. There are certain standards. Turkey is different to the average European country in many ways, even despite all the years of Ataturk secularism. I don't want to make it as if the Europeans are being totally unreasonable. I mean, there's two sides to every story. But what I can say is, as long as Turkey keeps getting fobbed off, it will be tempted, and perhaps already has been tempted, to start looking eastward. Turkey is already talking about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, dominated, of course, by China. You know, the word Shanghai, Russia, most of the Central Asian countries. I think Iran is involved with this too. Now, none of these places are known for being robust democracies and free market economies. And Erdogan says, we're better off with the SCO than the EU. Now, maybe he was in a bad mood when he said that, or maybe he actually means it. But if he means it, he's hobnobbing with countries that have very dubious convictions about democracy, freedom of speech, human rights, and so on and so forth. That's not how it's been in Turkey, but we just have to watch. In addition to that, we're seeing an increasingly autocratic form of government happening in Turkey. After the failed coup of 2016, literally tens of thousands of professionals, teachers, judges, all kinds of people were imprisoned or lost their jobs, literally within 2 or 3 days. How did they even compile the list that quickly after the failed coup? We wonder. And then there's talk about the Ottoman Empire coming back. Even Turkish leaders musing about places and cities that were once part of the empire that yet today belong to another country, as if they're still part of Turkey. And the word Neo-Ottoman, N-E-O hyphen Ottoman, is being used more and more. So also, listen to this. There's talk of a Turkish Islamic Union. I'll tell you about that in a moment. If you want to have a little litmus test of when secularism, or if secularism, will leave Turkey and it goes religious, then I want to introduce you to a very special place. It's called the Hagia Sophia. Has anyone been to the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul? It is to Istanbul what St. Peter's Basilica is to Rome. It has been one of the most magnificent buildings, church buildings, in history. It was the masterpiece of Byzantine Emperor Justinian, and he dedicated it in the year 537 AD. And so for nearly 900 years, it was Christendom's most magnificent building, magnificent basilica, magnificent church. If you went to a service in the Hagia Sophia and heard the choir singing, you could be forgiven to think you had gone to heaven. They were angelic. It was an amazing experience. But in 1453, a 21-year-old named Mehmet II, 21 years old, managed to do what other Muslims failed to do. He captured Constantinople, and he annexed it to the Ottoman Empire. When he captured it, 1453, that was the end of the 1,100-year-old Byzantine Empire. Remember, the Byzantine Empire was known as the Roman Empire in the East. And the Byzantines didn't see themselves so much as Byzantine. They saw themselves as Romans. And if you want to understand or get a little taste of the Byzantines, go to a Greek Orthodox church. As my estimation, they're the last souvenir of this great empire. It's Greek. It's a Greek empire. They spoke Greek, thought Greek. Orthodox Christianity was the leading religion, and so on. Well, Mehmed turned this building into a mosque, which is not what normally happened, but he did. Why did he turn it into a mosque? Well, first of all, Constantinople, became Istanbul later, didn't have a mosque. So he said, they've got to have one. Here we have. The second thing, he says, I need to turn it into a mosque, because if I don't, then the Muslims might destroy this building. So all the icons and the religious art was cover up in the Hagia Sophia, and they had these beautiful Arabic inscripted things about from the Quran. And then in 1935, Ataturk turned this Hagia Sophia, which means holy wisdom in Greek, into a museum. And it's been a museum ever since, because Turkey is secular. I have heard Erdogan, I've read the quote, and there's been a little rumblings that the Hagia Sophia should become a mosque again. Now think about it. The Blue Mosque is literally across the street from the Hagia Sophia. And up till now, most Turkish mosques are half empty, even on a Good Friday. Why on earth do you need another mosque when you can't even fill the ones you've got? Well, the Hagia Sophia is a very potent symbol of Turkish secularism. I actually said to my Turkish guide, he's a Muslim, nice guy named Ali, big smile on his face all the time. And I said, Ali, if the Hagia Sophia becomes a mosque, does that mean the end of Turkish secularism? And he looked at me, he never thought of it before, and he says, yes, I think you're right. If that turns into a mosque, bye-bye Ataturk's legacy. Turkey will have formally begun a transition into a realm I'm not sure we're going to like to see. So, Turkish Islamic Union. What on earth is that? There's a Turkish imam called Harun Yahya. And he was interviewed by Richardson. There's two of them. Joel Richardson. He's written some interesting books. I think they're well researched. And Joel Richardson interviewed him, and some of the things he learned is that there's this Turkish Islamic Union. Turkey is going to lead the Muslims again, like she has done on and off for the last 1,000 years. All the holy relics are in Turkey, according to Yahya. I didn't even know Islam had relics. Well, they do. And then he says the Mahdi, M-A-H-D-I. He's the enlightened one. He is Islam's redeemer. He is sought for not just by the Iranian Shia, but also by the Sunni. The enlightened one, the Mahdi, is coming. He's going to bring peace and security and rid the world of oppression and terrorism and everything else. And so this is going to be spawned from the Turkish Islamic Union that they tell us is going to come. What is very interesting, Erdogan, according to Yahya, is very much embracing this. Now, we haven't heard this from Erdogan yet, at least I haven't. So let's just watch and see. Remember, friends, those who have been coming and listening to me over the years, you always heard me say, watch Turkey. Now I've given you more ammunition in this watch. So we're told that Erdogan is very much eager to promote the union. By the way, if he's doing that, it couldn't be a secular Turkey anymore. He's doing it with railways across the region, pipelines across the region, and being very active in Middle Eastern politics. Erdogan more than once has tried to broker peace, especially with Israel and her neighbors. Nothing wrong with trying to make peace, but just remember, also in Scripture, some fairly nefarious people want to make peace. And that's why we read, first of all, before we read it, according to Yahya, the Turkish Islamic Union is going to give Israel and Palestine the peace they have so much longed to get. And almost like he will do what nobody else has succeeded to do. They say President Trump of the United States, he is a wheeler dealer, he's a negotiator, he wrote a best-selling book, The Art of the Deal, and that an Israel-Palestine peace treaty would be the ultimate deal, according to Trump. Well, I guess we're looking at, through this union, that ultimate deal. Peace between Israel and Palestine. And I'm reminded of the words of 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 3. And when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them, as labor pains upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. So with that, what else do we learn? Could a revived Ottoman Empire introduce the Mahdi? Could a revived Ottoman Empire, or just a Turkish Islamic Union, no Ottoman Empire, could it be the King of the North spoken of by the prophet Daniel? And we traditionally see the King of the North in Daniel, especially Daniel 11, as Antichrist. Could this Mahdi, this leader, this peacemaker be the man riding on the white horse? Because apparently he does. He rides on a white horse. Could Turkey turn on Israel? Currently, Turkey and Israel have diplomatic relations. They've had a very roller coaster ride in the days of Erdogan. Turkey and Israel, for 15 years, not only had diplomatic relations and robust trade, but they had a military alliance from 1996 to 2011. But after the Mavi Marmara incident, the Turkish ship that was boarded by the Israeli commandos, they were trying to bust the Israeli siege of Gaza, and 9 or 10 Turks were killed, and then the relations went down. In 2016, Erdogan, leaving from Saudi Arabia, made a comment, Turkey needs Israel, and Israel needs Turkey. And the relations were fully restored. But you see, they were restored, and then they can turn again. Anything is possible. Someone, wise person, said, no nation has permanent friends or permanent enemies. They just have permanent interests or national interests. Will Turkey's national interests turn it against Israel and help to instigate Ezekiel 38 and 39? Let me read that passage to you again. Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and I will turn thee back and put hooks in to thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth and all thine army, Persia, Sudan, and Libya, Gomer, and the house of Togarma. What is this conflict about? Well, let me tell you that this conflict, which is very detailed and fascinating, Ezekiel 13 and 39, is a last day's invasion of Israel from a power in the north, the king of the north. It includes three other main allies, clearly identified as Libya, Sudan, and Iran. Notice it's not the Arab neighbors so much, apart from maybe Libya. It's the outer ring of neighbors. And as I said earlier, five out of the eight place names are in Turkey. I know that common wisdom says that Gog is Russia. That is a very common perception. But you got two challenges. One, tell me one place name that is in Russia. Yes, Russia is to the far north of Israel, according to the prophecy. But you've got to go by the place names. And those place names appear to be in Turkey, not in Russia. The second thing is you've got a growing Russian church. Turkey, on the other hand, despite having the seven churches of Asia, the Greek presence, the Armenian presence, and so on, the amount of Turkish believers is scandalously low. Out of 79.7 million people in Turkey, probably 10,000, 15,000 are Christian, indigenous Turkish Christians. Look at the nation of Iran that has none of the degree of freedom and democracy that Turkey has, and they probably got at least a million plus Iranian believers and growing by the day. Isn't that amazing? One country is much more gospel friendly than the other country, even though the second country is very democratic and westernized and secular. It's sort of like, why is China's church growing so much and Japan's church, which is more westernized, a little less? Good question. Who's who in Ezekiel 30 and 39? This invasion happens in the last days. It's a spontaneous invasion. It happens without notice. It is so overwhelming that Israel is about to be destroyed, but she is saved by divine intervention. Not everyone agrees with this theory, but some teachers who I respect, I mean, they could be right, they could be wrong, say this Ezekiel 30 and 39 is the same thing as Armageddon. And they really build up a good case. Search the scriptures, be good Bereans, and see for yourself. So who's who? Well, Tugarma is southeast Turkey. Meshech is Phrygia in Turkey. Tubal is in eastern Turkey. And Magog is actually Central Asia, which of course is Turkestan. And Gomer is Cappadocia or Cappadocia. Cush is Sudan. Put is Libya. Persia is Iran. And Gog, possibly the Antichrist himself. And so as we look at this topic of Turkey in transition, I urge you, first of all, to keep your eyes on this great nation and to pray for this great nation. If you have a chance, go visit this great nation. Go to a local Turkish restaurant and do yourself a big favor as well. That will help whet your appetite for more interest. But I say again, it's not just watch Turkey, but and remember this, if Turkey stays secular, there will be a high degree of relative stability in the Middle East because Turkey holds the balance of power. If, on the other hand, Turkey jettisons secularism, goes eastward, goes religious, goes messianic, looks for this Turkish Islamic Union, and basically wants to help make peace in the region, then that's another story. With that, let's just take a look at the Gog and Magog invasion coming from the north, then from the west, from Put, that's Libya, coming from the south, that's Sudan, and coming from the east, that's Iran. When that happens, and it could, we don't know when it will happen, all I can say is our redemption is drawing nigh. God bless you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast from Breakthrough Church. We hope it helps you in your life as a follower of Jesus. If you have any questions or would like someone to talk to or to pray with, we would love to hear from you. You can find all of our contact details at breakthrough.org.au. Have a great week.